wheelchair, but the way she said it sounded jaded. Whatever Agnes Huntington had seen of the world had taught her to be wary. "I want to ask you about the fire." She said it plainly, as if propelled by a natural curiosity. "The newspapers all made it sound like an unfortunate accident." "Was it?" "It was indeed unfortunate."
"But was it an accident?"
The wheels rattled as they rolled over a few stones along the path. Paul thought about what it would be like to confide in her, given what he now knew about Edison. It was pleasant to imagine her as his ally, but could he trust her? Of course he couldn't. "It was an awful accident, Miss Huntington. One of Tesla's new and untested machines likely started the fire, though there's no way to be sure. We still don't know what happened to him." "Have you heard anything from your friend Stanford White?"
"I haven't been out much of late. My mother was put a bit on edge by the near death of our attorney. She's at a peak state of protectiveness. But the Vanderbilts had their yearly seasonal last week, welcoming those who decamped for the summer. I glimpsed Stanford there and inquired after Tesla." He pouted. He'd lost a new toy just when he was enjoying it the most. "Seemed like he considers Tesla dead."
Agnes paused.
"God, is that horrible of me? He was your friend."
It would have been hard to describe Tesla as anyone's friend, exactly. "I felt responsible for him. I still do."
"You're not responsible for his death."
Paul paused before answering. He had to tread carefully.
"I'm still not sure he is dead, Miss Huntington."
"Why?" "I'm alive, aren't I?" The weather was turning. It was time to go inside. By the time George Westinghouse visited again a week later, Paul had graduated from his rickety wheelchair to a wooden cane. Its squat nub thumped satisfyingly against the dirt as the two men walked in the chill of Bellevue's rear gardens. Just below lay the wind-chopped East River. Paul had almost been weaned off his morning cocaine, but looking at the water still made him slightly dizzy. Paul wore the brown hospital overcoat that comprised his uniform for outdoor walks. He hadn't worn any of his own clothes in a month. He'd never imagined that he'd find himself missing his few suits so much.
"So you are confident that one of Edison's hatchet men set the fire?" asked Westinghouse.
Paul was relieved to finally be able to confide in his client in person. He and Westinghouse had exchanged cables in the past weeks after he had achieved lucidity, but he hadn't dared risk revealing his suspicions until they were face to face.
"Yes," said Paul. "You know Charles Batchelor. What wouldn't he do for his boss?"
"I'm sorry," said Westinghouse suddenly. Paul was startled to hear the words from his client. He didn't get the impression that Westinghouse said them frequently, certainly not to a subordinate like Paul.
"I led you onto the battlefield, and now you're the one with the war wounds."
"Sir," said Paul as he pressed his cane hard into the dirt and turned to face his companion, "this is not your fault. I chose to go up against Edison. If you're feeling scared, you've every reason to be. If you're feeling uncertain, that only means you understand the complexity of our situation, but if you're feeling guilty, that won't help us a bit. You want to apologize to someone, apologize to Tesla. He's the innocent in all of this. But in order for you to have such a conversation, we'll need to find him first." Westinghouse looked away as Paul delivered this speech. He seemed uncomfortable with any display of sentiment. His gesture of apology could not have been easily offered.
"If he is alive, God willing, how will you find him?" asked Westinghouse. "I can call on the Pinkertons."
"No."
"You don't trust them? Do you?"
The Pinkerton Detective Agency was the preeminent investigative force in the United States.
and yet the Pinkertons had a reputation for committing their allegiance according to the generosity of their employers. If Edison had been able to exert enough pressure to control the police force, then to do the same to the Pinkertons would be a trifle.
"It's just us, then," replied Westinghouse finally.
"Yes."
"And your partners. They came to me a few weeks back. While you've been incapacitated, someone had to continue our defense on the light bulb suit." Paul was well aware. It was only proper for Carter and Hughes to take the reins, yet it still stung that his injuries had only furthered his demotion.
"Good," replied Paul.
"Carter and Hughes can handle the lion's share of legal strategy for a bit. They're quite experienced."
Paul gazed out at the East River. He steadied his vision on a pair of boatmen paddling a tiny craft on the icy water. Across the river lay the city of Brooklyn, a vast metropolis of Irish, Germans, Negroes, Jews, Italians, Danes, Finns, and a few well-to-do old families. Brooklyn was the third largest city in America, and it was largely inhabited by people who had not been born there. Behind Paul, the immense stone construction of Bellevue occupied the entire western skyline. The hospital's oversized American flag, with its 38 stars and 13 stripes, flapped in the breeze from the roof of the building. Paul could see more different worlds in one glance than in the entire town in which he'd been raised.
"When do they let you out of here?" asked Westinghouse.
2 more days, they're saying.
"I want you to be careful. No more nighttime expeditions. This is not worth dying over."
Paul was touched by the concern, and yet he didn't feel the warning was necessary. What would killing me get anyone? I can see Edison attempting to frighten me off. He tried as much the first time he met me, but actually murdering me? It might delay the case, but it wouldn't eliminate our defense, and frankly, a delay would benefit our side since he's the one asking for an injunction against your continued production of light bulbs. Westinghouse appeared unsure about where Paul was headed with this argument. Which leaves the only possibility remaining. The arsonist was trying to kill Tesla.
"Why?" asked Westinghouse.
"Because it's the only way to guarantee that he could never help us. Edison knows how difficult it will be to create a new non-infringing light bulb without Tesla's gifts."
"And you just happened to be there? That's rotten luck, kid."
"I'm not saying it was an accident that I was there."
"How do you mean?"
"How do you think they found Tesla?"
"Christ," said Westinghouse. "He had you followed."
The two men looked around at the churning East River.
"As soon as you leave here," said Westinghouse, "you'll likely be followed again."
"The bad news is that we don't know where Tesla is. But hopefully, neither does Edison."
"How will either of you find him? Tesla has no family in this country. You said that his one friend, Stanford White, believes he's dead."
"Which means there's only one other person we know about who's been in touch with Tesla since he left your employ. And, helpfully, he and I already have a good bit of history together."
Chapter 28. A Frightful Accusation. No matter how many instances of white swans we have observed, that does not justify the inference that all swans are white. Karl Popper. By the time Paul stepped into Lemuel Serrell's office 2 days later, he'd shed his plaster of Paris cast. His limp wasn't terrible, but it was annoying. He still required the wooden cane. He came to see Tesla's patent attorney hours after being discharged from the hospital, making only a brief trip back to his apartment for fresh clothes. The hospital rags had made him feel weak. Returning to the de rigueur deep black coat and tall white shirt collar of his professional life, Paul felt instantly stronger.
Cyril was smoking behind his desk when Paul entered. He did not offer greetings as Paul sat. Cyril remained in his chair, a hard expression across his face.
"I'm surprised you've the gall to walk right in here," said Cyril.
"Good morning," said Paul, surprised by the cross tone. "I'm feeling much healed. Thank you for asking." Cyril raised an eyebrow. He was the sort of man who knew the communicative value of a carefully raised eyebrow. "I'm here to find Tesla, to make sure he's safe."
"You, of all people, want to make sure that Tesla is safe?"
Paul stared at the angry face before him. It took a long moment to realize that Cyril was making a dreadful accusation.
"You think that I set the fire in Tesla's lab? Why on earth would I do such a thing?"
$2.50 per unit is quite a bit of money for your client, Mr. Cravath." Paul had never before been accused of attempted murder. The sensation was not pleasant.
"Listen to me very carefully, will you?" said Cyril.
"I can assure you that Mr. Tesla's demise will not help you in the slightest. His mother is in Serbia. In the event of her son's death, she will receive the entirety of the royalties owed him. I prepared his will myself. So whatever attempts you are making to finish the vile job you started, they are pointless."
"Mr. Cyril," said Paul in what he hoped was a reasonable tone, "do you see my cane? I was with Mr. Tesla when the fire started. I almost died."
"The police have been here. They told me you were with Tesla, which is precisely my point. If you knew where Tesla's laboratory was located, I do believe that makes us the only two men who did. Only one of us had a reason to want Tesla buried."
"What of Thomas Edison?" suggested Paul. "He had more reason to harm Tesla than any of us."
Cyril had prepared patent applications for Edison years before. Perhaps their work together had not concluded a decade past.
"Edison," Cyril smirked. "But that's stupid."
"Why?"
"Because if Thomas Edison had wanted Nikola Tesla dead, then he damn well would be."
Cyril directed Paul's attention to the door. "I'd ask you kindly to leave, though I've little intention of being kind. What convinces me of your culpability in the plot to murder my client is that I believe he's very much alive. And based on my previous dealings with you, I think you're the only one incompetent enough to botch it up."
Paul's injured leg wobbled a bit as he rose, but he remained unflinching. He would not be bested by Lemuel Cyril. Not again. "I don't know whether you are Edison's knowing accomplice or his unwitting pawn," said Paul. "But I know he's responsible for what happened. And I will not allow him or you to frame me for it." With that, Paul turned and walked out the door. It was only after crossing the threshold that he realized he wasn't even using the cane.
Chapter 29. Dead Ends and False Leads. Normal science does not aim for novelties of fact or theory, and when successful, finds none. Thomas Kuhn, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions. In the week following his confrontation with Lemuel Cyril, Paul paid visits to the American Institute of Electrical Engineers, the offices of the journal Electrical World, where he spoke to its editor, Thomas Martin, Westinghouse's laboratory in Pittsburgh, where he spoke with Fessenden, and the labs of half a dozen smaller New York outfits that might have employed engineers who'd worked with Tesla previously. None of these visits, despite Paul's beseeching, despite his charms, despite his $2 bills folded into serious handshakes, bore fruit.
No one had spoken to Tesla since weeks before the fire. No one had known, they told him frankly, what in God's name Tesla had ever been going on about anyhow. And no one had seen him since he'd fled Westinghouse's operation in August. As far as anyone guessed, he must have been living in his new laboratory before it burned down. Paul tried hotels. He made the run of cheap flop houses on the Bowery, though he had a hard time picturing the maniacally clean inventor staying anywhere in which one might hear the rats not only at night, but at midday. He greased a half month's worth of wages into the palms of the city's concierges, but it was no use. No giant with a thick Serbian accent and a habit of misplacing verbs had been spotted. Paul considered venturing to the disreputable alehouses and even less reputable gentlemen's clubs, places known to provide some manner of sanctuary to men who preferred not to be found. But then he imagined Tesla attempting to speak with the inhabitants of one of Chelsea's infamous boarding houses, and the thought seemed so comical as to be easily disregarded. By the end of a week's searching, Paul was no closer to finding the vanished genius. His labors had served only to further delay the healing of his hurt left leg. His boots were worn, and his shins pulsed with a dull ache. He also exchanged brief letters with his second client, or clients. His correspondence had been entirely with Fanny Huntington, not her daughter. Shortly after Paul's release from Bellevue, Mr. Foster wrote to Fanny directly. As any blackmailer would, he cautioned her against involving lawyers in the matter before them. The more people who became involved, he said, the harder it would be for him to keep the details of this business quiet. He tried to depict Paul's involvement as the Huntingtons' biggest problem. Paul assured Fanny by post that he was working on the situation. Privately, he didn't know exactly what he was going to do, but he knew he'd better think of something soon. It pained him to think of the precariousness of Agnes's position and of how little he'd done to help her. Moreover, there remained the small matter of the billion-dollar patent suit, and the business of defending George Westinghouse's right to manufacture electric lamps was not going well. Paul's countersuit against Edison was defeated in the U.S. Circuit Court in Pittsburgh. Judge Bradley ruled that Edison's light bulb had been clearly differentiated from any of its predecessors. As such, Edison had not violated any of the patents that Westinghouse had purchased from Sawyer and Mann. Edison's patent remained inviolable. In Paul's absence, his senior partners had appealed. No one had much hope that they would win. He returned to the offices of Carter, Hughes, and Cravath on a Monday as the sky threatened to loose the year's first snow onto the city. As Paul took the steps up from the street and then mounted the iron staircase to the third floor, he felt a curious sensation. Returning to this familiar place felt both strangely comfortable and strangely foreign. He'd worked here for under a year, yet it felt as if he'd been a child when he first hung his overcoat on this brass rack. He both could not imagine how young he'd been, and at the same time could not fathom ever feeling young again. He found Carter and Hughes well into a meeting with a short man of serious demeanor. The attorneys and their guest appeared engrossed in a set of contracts. Paul gestured hello through the glass, but none of the three saw him. He returned to his office to begin, very slowly, to attend to the mountain of papers that had spawned there in his absence. It was only after the stranger had left that Hughes walked by Paul's office door. "Welcome home," said Hughes. Paul asked about their visitor. Hughes smiled with pride before he explained. In Paul's absence, Carter and Hughes had done what they did best. They'd made deals. Westinghouse's new business plan, the creation of a network of current that stretched from coast to coast, required more hands than merely his own to man the decks. It didn't make sense for Westinghouse to ship a whole generator and all the technicians required to set it up to Michigan, for instance. It would be much more efficient for a local shop to build it. Which suggested to Carter and Hughes that perhaps subcontracting out manufacture and installation to a series of smaller, local companies around the country would be prudent. Even Paul had to admit that it was a good plan. And so Carter and Hughes had begun the process of buying up small manufacturing companies throughout the East and Middle West. To be sure, the Westinghouse Electric Company did not have much of a store of capital on hand. The purchases needed to be strategic, carefully considered, and in many cases they could save money by subcontracting production out to these local entities rather than buying them outright. The most substantial of these deals had been made with a Mr. Charles Coffin, the president of the Thomson-Houston Electric Company, based in Lynn, Massachusetts. This was the gentleman who'd been signing contracts just that morning. His company had the capability to manufacture generators from Maine to Connecticut. Mr. Coffin's support would be invaluable. The Westinghouse team was assembling its players. Sitting in his office some days later, Paul overheard the arrival of a messenger. The boy told Martha that he had an envelope to be opened only by Mr. Cravath himself. Paul was expecting news of the case or a summons to appear in court, but the contents of the brief telegram were utterly unexpected. Mr. Cravath, please hurry to the new Metropolitan Opera House right away. We'll be in my dressing rooms. Have something you'll want to see. Sincerely, Miss Agnes Huntington. Chapter 30. The Metropolitan Opera House. Science seldom proceeds in the straightforward, logical manner imagined by outsiders. James Watson. It took Paul just a minute to hail a carriage, but 34 more to ride it to 39th Street. The Metropolitan Opera House occupied an entire square block. 7 stories tall and almost as wide, the Met stood above the less formidable sweatshops of the garment district. Only 5 years old, the Yellow Brick Brewery, as people had nicknamed it, retained a number of the design elements common to its neighborhood. The building did look more fit for manufacturing than for high art. The Met had been founded in 1883 as a great big thumbed nose in the direction of the Academy of Music, which had occupied a considerably more distinguished space at Union Square. The Academy admitted only the oldest of New York's old money to its velvet seats. Its 18 boxes had each been sold off to elite families some 50 years previous. None would ever be for sale again. Even as the city began producing enough millionaires to fill another 3 opera houses, the Academy's board of directors would not budge. Not even the Rockefellers, the Vanderbilts, or the Morgans were allowed in. So those 3 families, and their equally new-moneyed friends, got together and built their own opera house. The Met had been an instant success. And now, 5 years later, all the finest productions from Europe and Philadelphia came there first when they arrived in New York. The Academy had fallen in 86. Its manager gave a terse statement to the newspapers, "I cannot fight Wall Street." There was a lesson in all this, Paul thought. America was a place in which the powerful and the popular were doomed to an uneasy alliance. Money, even as old as New York's, was something. But it was no longer quite enough. The fashionable flexed the real strength that made the American muscle bulge. Fashion was popularity. Popularity was people. And it was to the people's ever-shifting tastes that even the wealthiest of this young nation sought to appeal. What's the use in being rich if not a soul admires you for it? Paul was greeted by the manager of the house, a tall man in a dinner jacket who kept watch over the scattered maids dusting and polishing the ornate fixtures that dotted the walls. As it was morning, the lamps along the corridors were off, but Paul could make out their shape from where he stood. The lamps were electric, and they were Edison's. Paul explained to the house manager that he was looking for Miss Huntington. It was only after he assured the suspicious manager that he wasn't some devoted fan in search of an autograph, but rather the prima donna's personal attorney that the man deigned to accept Paul's card. He soon reappeared, leading Paul into the cavernous theater at the center of the opera house. Their footsteps echoed beneath the domed ceiling. The sensation was eerie. 4,000 empty seats swept across the long floor and up the rear wall. Paul turned to peek at the 5 tiers of empty boxes that hung from the sides. To think of the scenes that took place nightly between those chairs. The backstabbing, the social climbing, the bitter family feuds played out at every intermission. The drama among the audience was famously more intense than what was performed upon the stage. Empty in the quiet morning, the house seemed pregnant with the promise of the night's warfare. The manager led Paul up onto the stage, past the curtains, and finally down a flight of rear stairs to a door on which the name Agnes Huntington shone in gold lettering. It would not have shocked Paul if it had turned out to have been etched in genuine gold. The manager knocked twice on the door and then announced Paul's name. It occurred to Paul that he had met 2 very different Agnes Huntingtons between her mother's house and the Players Club. Would he find a 3rd at the Metropolitan Opera? "They're waiting for you," the manager said before turning away. Paul stood for a moment, taking a breath. "They?" But the manager was already gone. The door opened with a creak, and Paul found the radiant face of Agnes Huntington before him. Her attire was informal, a tastefully casual black dress that extended to the ankles and down her arms, with just a slight touch of white frill at the wrists. She wasn't wearing shoes. "Mr. Cravath," she said as she ushered him into the dressing room. An enormous mirror covered one wall, lit up by a panel of Edison's bulbs along the edges. The mirror made the room look twice as big as it was. A desk for makeup rested below the mirror, next to which stood a costume rack. The row of hanging clothes was full of bright reds and blues, more saturated and luminous than Paul had ever seen. The light bulbs brought out the deep colors in the silk fabrics. Beside the dresses were 2 wooden chairs and a decorated daybed, on which perched a very tall man, who was rocking back and forth in his seat, mumbling to himself. "You already know Mr. Tesla," said Agnes, as she shut the door behind them. Chapter 31. Questions Yet Unanswered. Deciding what not to do is as important as deciding what to do. Steve Jobs. In Agnes's telling, Nikola Tesla had appeared at the Metropolitan Opera House early that morning. He had approached her as she'd arrived at the stage door. It had taken her a moment to recognize him as Paul's curious quarry from the Players Club, but Tesla had recognized her easily, as if he'd been seeking her out. He had addressed her by name, even though he was filthy and clearly unwell. He was unable to say more than a few words. She'd had to employ the house manager in escorting him to her private dressing room. There sat the prodigal inventor on the opera star's daybed. Paul was reminded of Tesla's taste for Delmonico's. Strange how this unaccountable man found himself so often in the lap of luxury. It was only as Paul approached that he could see just how shaken Tesla was. He seemed unaware of Paul's presence, mumbling under his breath. Paul strained to make out words among the sputtered noises and half-syllables.
Nicola, can you hear me?
He doesn't answer, but whatever questions you might have for him, I can promise I've got more to ask you.
Tesla's eyes were open, but they were fixed on a faraway point, as if the dressing room wall were a distant horizon. Paul realized that Tesla was wearing the same suit that Paul had last seen him in. The cloth was filthy. Tesla's cotton shirt had once been white, but was now yellow-brown from unspeakable stains. He reeked of pavement, sweat, and horse shit. It seemed to Paul as if the fence that typically separated Tesla from the outside world had risen and thickened into a full rampart. Normally, one could at least lob a few conversational balls over the wall, but now, nothing landed on the other side. Whatever derangement had overcome him, it had completely severed any ties between the man and the world around him. If Tesla's consciousness was in there, if, as Paul's father would believe, Tesla's soul was present somewhere inside his skull, it was now the sole citizen of an embargoed kingdom.
Has he said anything at all that might indicate where he's been or how he's survived?
Nothing.
Why on earth has he come to you?
Paul remembered how hypnotized Tesla had been by Agnes's singing at the Players.
I have absolutely no idea. The more interesting question is what you're going to do about it.
The situation was one of considerable complexity.
Who else knows that Tesla is here?
The house manager who met you in the lobby, said Agnes, but he has no idea who Tesla is.
What about your mother?
Yes, you have me pegged. Whenever anything noteworthy happens in my life, the first thing I do is tell mother.
Miss Huntington, this man is in danger.
Paul could see that her mind was spinning. His problem, he realized, would surely be turned into her opportunity.
You can rest assured that you were the first and only person to whom I sent word, Cravath. We should take him to a hospital straight away.
She was testing the waters, and he knew it. She wanted to see if Paul was willing to bring Tesla someplace public. It must have been clear from his face that he wasn't.
Unless, of course, there is some reason why you don't want anyone to know that Tesla is here, safe and sound.
At Bellevue, Paul had felt certain he could not trust Agnes. Nothing about this new encounter had changed his mind, but what choice did he have? Agnes was a bystander to this game. To the extent that she had any allegiance, it would be determined by the other players involved and what she might get from each of them. She needed Paul, at least for the time being. What Paul could trust, he realized, was not that she would never betray him, but rather that she would only do so when it became in her best interest. Which meant that he had to make sure it never was.
Someone is trying to kill this man.
Oh,
she said. Seems like they're doing a relatively poor job of it.
I lied to you before, when I said the fire was an accident.
Did you now?
You assumed as much, didn't you?
I do not assume, I consider. And I considered that quite likely. Who has it out for Mr. Tesla?
The look on Paul's face seemed to confirm her suspicions.
Do I think Thomas Edison personally came down to Grand Street and lit the kindling?
He said.
No. But I'm sure he was responsible for the fire.
Paul filled her in on the details of the case, and of the threat posed by Thomas Edison. She took this in without any sign of surprise or concern.
You sure know how to pick your enemies.
Agnes did not scare easily. Or at least, Edison was not the thing that scared her.
Your cast members, when will they arrive? Will you expect them in this room? They usually trickle in any moment now. We've each got our own room, so no one will demand entry here.
But they may come and knock, gossip, chit-chat, what have you. I have to get him somewhere safe. Where?
Paul's own apartment was small but serviceable. However, if one of Edison's men was following his movements, then Tesla would be discovered within hours. Paul's office would not do. His senior partners were untrustworthy. Westinghouse's estate would be too full of loose lips. The staff, the varied visitors moving through the house, the laboratory, the factories and gardens and private rail station, word would be bound to get out. Could Paul bring Tesla to a hotel? He would be at the mercy of a series of strangers, and strangers could be bought. Paul was no boy's adventure book hero. He'd never even read Jules Verne.
May I make a suggestion?
Said Agnes.
You'll need to store Mr. Tesla somewhere that Edison's men won't think to investigate. A place near enough that Tesla can be taken there quickly and big enough that you can keep him there for some time. A place owned by someone who could look after a troubled invalid and who would never, in a million lifetimes, be under suspicion by Edison or his men.
Her argument was sound, but when she spoke her suggestion aloud, Paul couldn't quite believe it.
You may keep Mr. Tesla in my home.
Your home?
Yes.
Why would you offer to keep Tesla in your home?
How could you possibly refuse?
Tesla muttered again from the daybed.
I can keep him there, she said. I can even get my mother to help. Don't give me that look. She's more amenable than she seems. We'll keep him warm and fed and safe, and then, once he's regained his senses, such as they are, you'll get him to rejoin Westinghouse and create the device you need.
The public will purchase Westinghouse's systems rather than Edison's, and then you will, I believe, be the lead litigator for the largest and most influential company in America. You and Westinghouse can buy the Boston Ideals if Mr. Foster threatens me again. Agnes's bare toes tapped soundlessly against the wood floor. Her presentation had been matter-of-fact, and having concluded it, she did not expect much argument.
You don't trust me? Said Agnes.
I trust you a little, said Paul. You're asking me to trust you a lot. At any moment, all Agnes would have to do was speak a few ill-considered words at a dinner, and both Tesla's life and Paul's career would be over.
If you're worried that I'm going to sell you out to Edison, perhaps you should think on it this way. If I want to, I already can.
He blinked. She had a point. Paul found himself both impressed and afraid of her, in equal measure.
You should be a lawyer, he said.
Taking this as a sign of assent, Agnes went to her clothing rack. She removed a long green coat and a pair of small, flat shoes.
We'll have to get him into new clothes so he won't be recognized. The costume department will have plenty. Then you and I will need to leave separately. If Edison is having you followed, we can't take any chances. A few minutes after you go, I'll take him to a carriage and get him to Gramercy. What will you tell your mother?
That's my problem, she said as she slipped the soft shoes under her feet.
I've a performance tonight. Come over after to check on him. Midnight, on the dot. All right. Now, help him up.
Paul felt nervous about leaving Tesla again. After finally locating him, he was letting him once again out of his sight. And yet, he had no other choice. Paul turned quickly to Agnes.
Thank you, he said.
I promise this affair will not distract unduly from your singing.
Well, I'll tell you an awful secret about the opera,
said Agnes as she rang the bell for a stagehand.
It's the same show every night.
Chapter 32. Nightly Terrors at Number 4 Gramercy Park. Just because something doesn't do what you planned it to do doesn't mean it's useless. Thomas Edison.
Paul decided that he would not say a word to Westinghouse about the sudden reemergence of Nikola Tesla. Not now. How could he? Westinghouse was isolated in Pittsburgh and without much experience in high society subterfuge. He was a blunt boss with little patience for dissembling. If Westinghouse knew, then so might a half dozen top engineers in his lab, or any of the executives in his manufacturing divisions, all of whom had worked for Westinghouse for years longer than Paul had. Paul trusted Westinghouse with his life. But he could not trust him with this secret. Not yet. Paul grew angry. Not at himself for deciding to withhold pertinent information from his client. Not at Tesla for his mental instability. Or at Carter and Hughes for their small-minded treacheries. Not at Westinghouse for being so unsuited to secrecy as to require being deceived. Paul was angry at Thomas Edison. This soul-corroding position in which he found himself was the result of a war that Edison had started. Thomas Edison was the devil himself. And the real measure of his villainy was the behavior he'd forced on Paul. That evening, Paul paid the first of many nighttime visits to Gramercy. Most nights after leaving the office, he would descend from the hanging step of his carriage between the hours of 11 and 12 and peer quickly around the park. He would search for signs of anyone watching, but of course in such a vibrant setting it would be impossible to tell. The restaurants and alehouses along Irving Place overflowed with revelers, young men and women promenading gaily beneath the street lamps even into the winter. The theater at Irving Plaza was only a few blocks down, and if Paul happened to arrive when a show was getting out, he would find the streets flooded with merry music lovers. In all the visits he paid to Agnes's house, he never failed to hear a tune in the air outside it. Gramercy was not the sort of neighborhood that would take too much notice of a young man paying late-night visits to an actress's darkened home. On Paul's first visit, Fanny was the one to open the door and bid him to enter. She tilted her neck back to stare him straight in the eyes. "I don't like this," she informed him. "Were I in your position, I wouldn't like it either, Mrs. Huntington. If there were any other solution, I can promise you that I wouldn't be here, and neither would my suffering friend."
"My daughter has come too far in too short a time to be set back by the blackmail of a dishonest theater manager, the debauched soirees of high-fashion pedophiles, the rantings of a head-sick lunatic, or the schemes of a wily attorney just slightly too clever for his own good. My daughter likes you. I don't. So you may rest assured that I will turn on you and your friend Tesla at the very first opportunity you give me to do so."
However Agnes had convinced her mother to allow them to host Tesla, it had worked. Still, she could hardly be called a willing accomplice to their plans. Understandably so. If the wrong eyes caught sight of the small-hour visits a young man was paying to her daughter, there would be hell to pay. This would be the longest of Paul and Fanny's interactions. He would typically nod a hello in future visits. She would scowl in return. They exchanged little beyond the barest of formalities. On some nights, Agnes would be home upon Paul's arrival, on other nights not. After the first few days, she gave Paul a key so that he might let himself in. But he still felt it impolite to enter without warning. Some proprieties, at least, must be preserved. Inside, Paul would be greeted by the flickering gas lamps along the smoothly carved vestibule. He'd hang his coat, and once November had given way to early December, he'd smack the snow from his scuffed leather boots. Tesla had been given a small bedroom on the second floor that had once been a maid's quarters. He spent most of his time in bed, in a pair of Paul's pajamas. When Paul would enter, he would invariably find Tesla under the sheets. Yet the inventor did not seem to sleep much.
He was having visions. That became clear as soon as Paul had been able to coax a few words from Tesla's lips. The words that finally came as Paul sat by his bedside were faint.
"A great winged beast," said Tesla.
He said little else that Paul could understand that first night. On the second, he produced a few more words, but no greater meaning.
"A fire," Tesla said. "All I see is fire."
"Yes," Paul exclaimed. "There was a fire in your laboratory, but that was months ago. You escaped and you're safe now." Tesla shook his head defiantly.
"No, no, 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 no. With us here, I see a fire engulfing around us all."
On future evenings, Tesla would describe further visions. There was talk of horned beetles. Then there were bloody rivers and a solar eclipse of infinite length. Eventually, he described an undead army and a colony of ants whose bodies were comprised of particles from distant stars. As the days passed, Tesla's descriptions grew more verbose. He invariably spoke as if these terrible sights were not dreams, but scenes before his waking eyes. They were all as real to him as Paul, Agnes, and Fanny, as palpable as his small bed and the single candle that lit his room. Paul brought a fresh box of saltines every night. Tesla devoured them ravenously. He seemed so hungry, yet he wouldn't eat anything else. How Tesla hadn't long ago perished from scurvy, Paul could not imagine. As the nights went on, and Paul helped Tesla to his crackers, he attempted to get more information about the nature of Tesla's condition. The inventor knew who Paul was. He had some memory of their history together. By the second week, Tesla even referred to him by name, just as he had with Agnes from the start. However, the names Edison and Westinghouse seemed to have little effect on him. He either didn't remember who they were, or, in his current state, didn't care. Yet Tesla's presence had the most unexpected effect on Agnes. She seemed to honestly like having him there. Often Paul would arrive to find her already at Tesla's bedside. Often she'd stay after Paul left. Tesla seemed to soften her, to smooth the edges in her practiced smiles. When she laughed with Tesla, it was a different laugh than the one she'd boomed at Stanford White's party, or even than the little ones she offered to Paul. With Tesla, her laugh was warmer. It wasn't comedy. It was companionship. She seemed to be able to understand Tesla more than Paul ever could. She was more adept at deciphering his torturous grammar. She was even fascinated by his rambling monologues. "You like him," Paul said to her one night as they ascended the staircase to Tesla's room. He'd just arrived and his cheeks were still red from the cold. Her quarrel with W.H. Foster still loomed over them, but Paul had already decided that another letter would not do the trick. He would have to come up with something better.
"It surprises you that I like Tesla?"
"He doesn't seem of a piece with most of your circle."
"I've spent a lot of time performing. On the stage for money, and off the stage for respect. He's never done so a day in his life. It would never even occur to him. He cares about no one's opinions but his own."
Together they entered Tesla's room. They found him, as usual, mumbling to himself. The winter wind slapped hard against the thick windows, providing a low accompaniment to their quiet conversation.
"Ships," said Tesla. "The particles that are moving, sliding, pressing up against, they are like tiny ships. We must see what they bring. We must trace the waters of their journey."
Paul looked at Agnes. Together, they had heard so many of these monologues. Together, they would be here the next night, and the night after that, to hear so many more.
Particles. They are ships only, are they not? I will make a machine to push them into the waters, to connect one port with another. I cannot believe no one has thought of it previous. It is obvious when you have seen the boats.
Agnes leaned over the bed, hoping to hear him better.
It's a coil, Miss Agnes Huntington. The shape is coiled. Can't you see it there? It shines from its wonder.
Paul looked around the cramped bedroom.
There's nothing here, said Paul. Your mind is conjuring up things that aren't there.
At this, Tesla turned to Paul, and for the first time since his reappearance, matched Paul's gaze with genuine consideration.
Exactly, said Tesla.
You're hallucinating, Nikola, said Paul.
No,
replied Tesla, with the very first smile that Paul had seen on his face in a long time.
I'm inventing.
Chapter 33. Mr. Edison would disagree. When an abnormal man can find such abnormal ways to make his name known all over the world, and to accumulate such wealth with such little real knowledge, I say such a man is a genius. Or let us use the more popular word, a wizard. Francis Gell, an assistant in Edison's laboratory, 1913. The next time Paul entered the Huntington house, he was met with an alarming development. The man he found by Tesla's bedside was of a solid build, bald, but wearing a bushy white beard across his cheeks with more than enough hair to make up for the lack up top. He was leaning over Tesla as Paul entered.
Ah, said the man, looking his way. You've brought the saltines.
Who are you? Agnes, at the foot of the bed, supplied an answer.
Don't worry, Cravath, she said. This is Dr. Daniel Toof. He's an alienist.
This proved the occasion of their first quarrel. After the doctor had left, Paul questioned her angrily.
How could you bring a stranger here without asking me?
He hadn't intended to yell, but he found his voice rising. I don't need your permission to determine how to take care of Nikola, she replied calmly. Agnes had met Dr. Toof months previous at Mrs. Astor's Halloween party. He was known among a certain crowd to be trustworthy. Men in his line of work could not afford to be otherwise. They were in the sitting room by then. Agnes sat patiently on the sofa while Paul paced about the room. She explained that the alienist was highly fascinated by Tesla's subconscious, as he described it. Paul asked what the word meant. Agnes admitted she hadn't a clue. She explained that the good doctor thought Tesla seemed to suffer from démence précoce, something like a precocious madness. Paul asked if that meant he was insane, but apparently Dr. Toof didn't think the term applied. This was the thing about these alienists, Agnes said.
They're doing away with sane and insane as categories. They've been working to mess the classifications up a bit, scientists of the mind, such as they are.
Did the doctor suggest a treatment? He asked.
Rest.
We've been doing that.
He pointed out something else as well. Tesla's amnesia? It hasn't extended to certain skills.
Such as?
English, for a start. Has it occurred to you that he hasn't been speaking to us in Serbian this whole time?
Paul had to admit that was an interesting point. She continued.
And his facility with mechanics. His speech is peppered with scientific terms, with
discussion of machines, particles, as well as winged beasts.
His visions, his hallucinations, said Paul. He keeps saying that they're inspiring him to build a new machine. He sees these things, he believes they're real, and that, to him, is inventing.
A flash of light, like St. Paul on the road to Damascus.
He told Westinghouse that he had the idea for his alternating current motor in a similar fit. This is Tesla's process. He has a series of hallucinatory episodes, and then there it is. His device is invented, and he moves on to something else. Agnes seemed fascinated by this process, if suspicious of its efficacy.
But you haven't invented something until you've built it. If I spend an afternoon staring down at sheet music and imagining how I'm to sing it, it cannot be said that I've performed the piece. I don't actually create the thing until I stand on a stage and move my mouth. My throat gets a bit tired, and then there's some applause at the end. It's different for him. Just saying that you've invented something is not the same as inventing it.
I think Mr. Westinghouse would agree with you. Paul trailed off.
Cravath, said Agnes. Is something the matter?
What if Mr. Edison would not agree with you? What if Edison believes that saying that you've invented something is just as good as inventing it?
Agnes's expression indicated that she had no idea what Paul was talking about.
Edison claimed to have invented the incandescent electric light bulb on September 16, 1878, said Paul.
Everyone knows that because Edison made a grand public declaration of his achievement. He announced it in the Sun. He gave private demonstrations to adoring reporters from the Herald and the Times. He patented the basic design of the device, the base, the circuit, all of that, right away.
But he didn't actually file for his patent on the bulb piece itself until a year later, on November 4th, 1879.
Paul felt a surge of energy. Here's what I'm asking. What evidence have we that Edison invented the light bulb when he said that he did?
You think he lied? The first patent Edison filed was vague. Or at least that's been my legal argument thus far. Edison filed a vague patent that covered far too wide an area. Only, what if Edison hadn't actually gotten the thing working at all? What if he simply told everyone he had? Imagine the situation from his perspective. He's working on a lamp. He's got dozens of engineers working 24 hours a day. He knows he's close, but he also knows that a number of other inventors are working on the exact same problem, and they're close as well. Hibbard, Swan, and Sawyer. They were all almost there.
So Edison just blurts it out? Said Agnes. He makes a big show to the press of saying, that's it, the game is over, I've solved the electric lamp, and then, said Paul, the others give up.
The great Thomas Edison just invented the indoor electric lamp. It's cut and dried, so they start working on other designs. But there was such a lag between the time that Edison announced his discovery and his patent application a year later, and then another year's lag before products were starting to sell in the marketplace. Westinghouse thought there might be space for another company to get involved. So did Hibbard, so did Swan, but no one ever stopped to think what evidence was there that Edison actually invented a working bulb.
There must have been demonstrations. Brief ones. A minute at a time, too. That's how they're described in all of the articles. A journalist or an investor would be let in to see the bulb for a minute, two at the most, and then ushered straight out. Supposedly, this was so that no one could view Edison's design long enough to steal it, but what if the demonstrations were so brief for a different reason?
That reason being that the bulbs didn't really work? Stability was the entire issue. No one could build a bulb that didn't explode within minutes and set fire to whatever was nearby. What if Edison's early bulbs, the ones he described on his first patent application, were still exploding?
But no one else knew because they were only seeing it for 2 minutes at a time.
Edison had 2 more years to perfect the thing, while everyone else was kicking themselves because they couldn't figure out how he did it. Paul and Agnes stared at each other.